I love plants, you know. That is the main thing of all. I love the way they change, the dynamics, and the beauty of everything that you can see in them. Even if plants are in decay, I know how beautiful they were when they were in flower, but I think if you see them at this time of the year, you don't expect anything else than plants dying and still looking good.
So from travel to the garden now, and that was the voice of Dutch landscape designer Piet Oldhoff in an upcoming documentary called Piet Oldhoff: Fall, Winter, Spring, Summer, Fall. And he was speaking there about his love of plants in all seasons. Amongst many other things, it's his celebration of the importance of death in the garden that has made Oldhoff such an inspiration to gardeners and designers the world over. One such inspiree, if that's a word it should be, is Sydney-based landscape designer Jane Stark. Jane, good morning.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for joining us. Look, before we get to the idea of developing a different relationship to death in the garden and the lifestyle of our plants, tell us a bit about how you first came to the work of Piet Oldhoff.
Through my study in landscape design, and also through a mother who's an avid gardener who also was interested in his work, I'm also an interior designer as well, so I was very drawn to his sort of dreamy use of texture and an artful use of colour. And then as I explored his philosophy more deeply and understood his aesthetic, I started to appreciate, death sounds very grim, but the beauty in the full life cycle of a plant and in selecting plants that shine through every season, really, whether it's the seed pod in their skeletal form, whether they're covered in leaves, so that really a garden gives joy in four different ways throughout its life cycle, but particularly there's still beauty in winter.
It's a lovely thought, that beauty of winter, and timely as the weather turns here. We're also joined in the studio by Ian Barker. Ian's a Melbourne-based landscape and garden designer. Ian, tell us about your own relationship with Oldhoff's work, and in particular what's often referred to as the new wave of garden design that he belongs to.
We came across plants. We've been designing gardens now for 30 years, but I was lucky enough to do the Chelsea Flower Show in London, and I saw a garden by Tom Stuart Smith, and it was this naturalistic planting, and I was drawn to it. I didn't know why I was drawn to it. And this idea that you design a garden for the sole purpose of showcasing plants rather than the Australian dominance of building a garden for the sole purpose of use. Now, I think in Australia we're starting to get that middle ground where it's both use and the beauty of plants. In discovering that garden, we then went on a search of more, and we came across Piet Oldhoff, in particular the Highline Project, and the life cycle of the garden. So down in Melbourne, we don't get enough of the seasons that we want, but we can do it.
We've touched on the Highline Project on this show in the past, but for those listeners who aren't familiar with it, talk us through it. Describe what that looks like and the role the garden plays in that project.
It's an extraordinary garden that, unlike yourself, Michael, I haven't had the opportunity to see it in the flesh, but I've studied it quite hard. It was a disused railway line that was going to be demolished, and a group of people called the Friends of the High Line got together to create a garden for people in New York to escape sort of this concrete jungle. And Piet Oldhoff was brought across to look after the plants. Now, the landscape architecture of this project is extraordinary, but I believe it's the most visited garden in the world today because of this naturalistic style that Piet brought into the planting. It from what I've been told and what I can see from the photographs, it has a sense that despite the fact that you're in a concrete jungle, you're immersed by nature.
It's really interesting how kind of immediate and naturalistic it is, and how the kind of artifice of a commercial garden doesn't seem to be there at all. It kind of feels like it's springing up naturally and organically. How much is that part of what you think of when you think of his work, Jane?
Well, it's very much part of his work. It's all about grouping plants that may naturally be together in nature. I think that's more of his latter work. It's very, woodland, prairie, meadow, and I think what I love particularly is his huge use of grasses. And in the winter, with a softer winter light, the way light catches grasses, it actually suits our native plants very much as well, because in their skeletal form, they're heavily seed pods and berries and things like that that are fantastic for winter gardens.
Well, it's that thing that you were talking about before, about colour and texture, the way in which, whereas we might traditionally look for the kind of lurid springtime colours to be what we expect from a garden in full bloom, those kind of more muted tones
and those winter tones. A lot more subtle colour palette of sort of rusty browns and charcoal and straw colours, and there's a lot of beauty in that, I think.
Jane, can you tell us in your own work, how do you try and use those same principles with Australian natives? What do you use in your garden designs?
Often reflect bark. Some beautiful barks in our indigenous trees, and particularly in eucalypts. Also, again, seed heads and grasses like lamandras. But obviously in Sydney, Ian, we don't even have the depth of perennials, and they're not always suitable for our climate up here, so it's often appropriate to throw in succulents as well, because of their very translucent style of leaves, the light is beautiful through those in the winter, and they can also complement beautiful colours of bark and grasses as well.
I'm interested in this, and Ian, I might bring you back in that question of the perennial. I mean, part of the perennial movement is about a response to seasonal change in the northern hemisphere and kind of somewhat more extreme conditions. How does it manifest itself differently in Australia, or do you think should it?
Well, it definitely has to be treated differently. We use some natives, but mostly exotics, mainly because that's sort of what we've been studying. We can't use everything that's been done in North America or in across Europe, and we're lucky enough. I have heard about the Sydney climate, and we did a talk in Adelaide recently, and they have a similar problem in Adelaide with the extremes. But in Melbourne, we have parts of Melbourne where we can get that climate change. And we also have some wonderful, wonderful perennial growers that we can get access to these plants. And we just used antique perennials for our flower show at the Melbourne International Flower and Show. Melbourne International Flower and Garden Show, better known as MIFCAS because it's easier to say. But Antique Perennials did all those, and they have some extraordinary plants that they've brought back across from America and Europe, so we get to play with a lot of plants. For us, though, we don't get that winter season, and the most obvious one is that we can't get frost-covered seed heads of the Echinacea, which we would all love to do. But we've found that by using less plants, we're not about to create a perennial garden with 50 different perennials in them. It's not what we're about. We're trying to limit our palette, and we quite often now use the word restraint and do swathes of groupings of plants that would be bigger rather than having one of these and three of these to create that naturalistic feel. So once we create a palette that we like, we then use repetition again and again and again, and those grass sea heads, sometimes we use them in a grid formation, so when you're looking at them from different angles, it all looks like one. In other ones, we scatter them, so deliberately scatter them in the old sort of Edna Walling potato throwing principles, but by doing that repetition, we do get a naturalistic feel.
I'm really interested by the way in which, as you say, you use the word palette there, it kind of expands the scope of what you're able to put out there. But I'm just curious about what it means when it comes to kind of convincing clients to have this different approach, because being comfortable with the idea that the full life cycle of the plant, even the plant in death, is something to be kind of nurtured and enjoyed and left there. I mean, tell us, Jane, is it difficult to convince clients that there's beauty at the end part of the cycle?
Well, it's obviously not for everybody. I think it's quite a sophisticated concept, and I think obviously our responsibility as designers is to inspire and paint a visual picture for our clients. But I think there's four times the pleasure, and that's the way that I inspire clients to come on board. And it is the seasonal variety, which you don't see a lot in Sydney if it's just a straight green garden, which seems to pervade. So it is about education, about the different seasonal change along the way, and the fact that every season has a completely different look. As things die down, as other elements of the garden are highlighted,
That's Ian, do you find that education process difficult? I mean, even your maintenance workers, I imagine, would have to be taught not to instinctively lop off dead seed heads and the like.
You've completely read my mind. We find with the clients, the inspiration is, you know, they've seen what we can do and they are inspired by that, the potential of what they can do. And we instantly explain to them that this is not an exact science in Australia yet. And I think the idea of experimenting together is actually quite one of excitement with the clients. So we found the clients that want to do this and embrace and explore this have easily done. But from a maintenance point of view, the natural instinct for the last 100 years has been, you know, as soon as it finishes flowering, you cut it off. We want to have this beautiful mulched soil where, from my perspective, I don't want to see any soil. So it's re-educating gardeners to this style of planting that, again, is relatively new here.
And not to fetishise the green in the same way. Is that a reasonable?
Well, it's not mono. I call them monotone gardens. And, you know, in the 90s in particular, there was a row of one dark green and then a row of another dark green. And then if we were really lucky, we had a darker green on the background. And it was wonderful to see at this year's flower show that not only with our garden, but with a lot of the gardens, the emphasis of the plant life was put well and truly back on centre stage. And the number of people that just stopped and embraced them, whereas in past years I've watched them walk past going, oh yeah, that's nice, and they keep walking, whereas this year they seem to be a lot slower.
It's a lot more of an emotional reaction, isn't it, to the plants, I think.
I'm interested in that. Why? Do you think it's a more personal connection when
I think it feels more like nature. It feels more like the countryside. And I just think when you see a far greater variety of plants, it does evoke far more emotion.
Well, yeah. As we head out into an Australian winter, you've given us much to think about when it comes to making a virtue of all the seasons in the garden. Quite apart from anything else, you've both given me an excuse not to go home and deadhead my roses this weekend, so I'm happy with that. That's a good thing. The bit of the documentary we heard up the top was a documentary about Pete Odolph called Pete Odolph, Fall, Winter, Spring, Summer, Fall by US-based Tom Piper. And I've been speaking with garden designers Jane Stark and Ian Barker. A link to Jane's wonderful article on the Plant Hunter blog is on the Blueprint for Living part of the RN website.